I will hear from wrong, and I'll die in the
air. Welcome to our group.
And this ought to show it right here.
Do you or someone you know suffer from depression? If so, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our Defender 7 rescheduled Tuesday night medical broadcast with your host, our Colonel, Kimberly Purvis. And I'm your co-host and general of the Defender 7, Bobby Ormsby. Now, before we get on with our broadcast, I need to read our disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed on Defender 7 radio show and Facebook page are those of the callers and or authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Defenders 7. Now, for those of you new just tuning in, we also have a national Facebook page. If you will type in all capital letters in the search box, Defenders 7, just know before you hit that join button that we expect all of our members and future members to participate in everything we do throughout the Defender 7. Now, if you get in and you don't feel that it's a fit for you, you may leave with no hard feelings. We're not just a group, but we feel that we are more of a family, an extended one, and we treat each other as such. We also have a website. If you will type in all lowercase letters, www.defendersromannumeralv2i.com. On our site, you will find that we have a store and a donate button. Everything we do here at the Defender 7 relies on sales from our store and donations that we bring in. That's the only way that we're able to operate during a time of a natural disaster or shit hits the fan situation. All 100% of all sales and donations and any type of money we bring in goes back to our communities throughout all 50 states in a time of need. So by all means, please purchase something or hit that donate button. Every little bit helps. Help us to help you and your communities. Now for tonight's show and all the shows we do here on Blog Talk Radio, we enjoy it when you call in with your own opinions or just to join in on the conversation. And that number to call, area code 914-205-5773. Again, the number to call to participate, area code 914-205-5773. Also, when you get a chance, head over to YouTube, check out our Defender 7 YouTube page. Do us a favor and hit that subscribe button. We're also on MeWe. Click on organizations, scroll down, Defender 7, Humanitarian American Patriot Group. And I will now bring in your host, our Colonel Kimberly Purvis, and also joining us as
usual,
our major from Wisconsin, Miss Lorna Munson.
Wisconsin. Was she disappear already?
I think she fell asleep already.
Good God.
No, I was trying something. Are you there?
I guess.
I'm here. It didn't work like I planned, but oh well. I tried.
Okay. Before we get started, my apologies for not doing the show yesterday. I couldn't see. I worked in my yard, and I don't know what the hell is in the if it's pollen or what, but I was moving my plants. That's in my plants, my herbs, and so my flowers, and I was moving them to the porch because, look, this 105-degree weather every damn day has got to go.
You know, excuses are like assholes. Everybody has one.
Yes, and you're ours. So whatever happened, my eyes swelled shut, and I couldn't see. I could not see. And so it's still pretty swollen, but I could see better, and, you know, it doesn't feel like I've got sandpaper in my eye. But there's two things that I wanted to bring up before the show. Bobby and I have been, we've been kind of like going back and forth about different things we've been hearing about what's going on. I saw a podcast this morning. I hope and pray to God it is true, because apparently August 29th, they are coming out with the audit results of the whole election, I guess, of whatever happened. So that's why you're seeing a rash of a lot of unusual shit happening. There's people that, and now this confirmed one thing. This one person who we thought was dead is not dead, because he talked through the whole entire podcast. But I'm not going to say anything else, but just wait till the 29th. The other thing is I put a video up in our chat room, and it's a list of 15 questions, and it's to see how if an apocalyptic event, a catastrophic event happened, would you survive? Okay? And these are 15 questions, right? And they're pretty relatively simple. And if you can get over 7 of them, you're pretty well, you know, good to go. 6 to 10, it says you get a 50-50 chance. And 10 to 15, you know, you're good. The first one is, can you shoot a gun?
I can shoot one.
Well,
no guarantee if I hit anything.
What size?
But the thing is, can you shoot a gun? Not be like,
yeah.
They're not saying, you may not hit whatever it is you're shooting at, but can you use what is what they're saying?
Oh, yeah.
Can you
absolutely
shoot and hit what I aim at?
Okay, can you forage?
Yes.
Or
huh?
Whatever.
To a point.
Do you know what herbal plants to use for medicine?
Yes,
that's
somewhat.
In your area. Can you climb
yes
a tree?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Can you? Hey, look, I'm broken, and I can still find a way to climb a tree. can you start a fire?
Yes.
Can you build a shelter?
Yes.
Can
Born
you
a liar.
Mend?
We already seen your mess of a shelter.
I hey, it worked. It wasn't pretty, but it worked.
You can't even put up a damn tent, let alone a shelter.
I can do it. I bet I can do a shelter better than a tent.
Yeah, the tents are kind of complicated. Those are rocket science. When you got put pole B into pole A and then pole C between. Yeah. See, that's why I like the ones that are collapsible. I like those. Just with the rope.
Oh, believe me, when I took it down, I made it collapse.
Okay, can you sew?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, can you sterilize water?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know how to use a tourniquet or find a way to make one? Okay.
Yeah.
Can you read a map?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you, do you know how to use a compass or navigate by the stars?
Yeah.
Somewhat.
Somewhat. Well, that's the same thing. Okay. Do you know how to hunt?
Yes.
Do you know how to fish?
Figure it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. This one is the only one that if someone showed me, yes, I would know. Can you preserve meat?
Yes.
Okay.
I got all of them.
Okay. Do what?
I got all of them.
We're not done yet.
And do you have your apocalypse team already picked out?
Yeah.
Like
not
around
hit
here.
The fan.
No.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah.
Well,
I do.
Everybody around here is. I'm standing my ground. I'm staying here. I'm gonna fight to the death of my own property.
Yeah, but the thing is, meeting up with other people is what I mean by have your team. Now, this could be for anything.
Well, I got my neighbors, but they don't go and buy ammo like we do, or you guys do, or I, you know, they don't
Our
think nothing's going to happen.
Oh, I know. Our freedom seeds for our boomsticks.
Right.
No, and the person that did the video, I think she got like 3 or 4 of them, and she goes, "Oh, I'm doomed." But that's the importance of that list right there. Can be for anything.
And
that could be
speaking
for
of that list, speaking of that list, that fish is mine, Bobby.
So
nope,
tonight we're going to do this.
Bad.
It is not. I got it to the hole. It's my fish.
You didn't land it, so therefore it's not yours.
Whatever. I did all the work.
Yeah, I know.
Oh. Do I really want to know what's going on here?
I caught a fish and my brother's trying to claim it. It's
go,
a 40-year-old argument.
Go to the messenger, Chris, and scroll up and look.
On the defender page.
Her brother caught a fish because she couldn't bring it in because she was too small.
Then you did not catch the fish.
Whatever.
You did not catch the fish. You might have helped a little bit, but you did not catch it.
Exactly.
I hooked it and I pulled it. I got it to
you
the hole.
You did not.
He who reels it in claims the fish.
See?
Right.
See? There we go.
Rest my case.
I reeled it in, my fish.
Nope.
Okay, so now we're doing the history of medicine. How it started.
What? You're cutting out.
The history of medicine.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I know. Oh, boy. Well, you know what? I ain't got shit, so that's just tough. So you got to know where you came from. So the history of medicine shows how societies have changed in their approach to illness and disease from ancient times to the present day. Early medical traditions include those of Babylon, China, Egypt, and India. Sushruta from India introduced the concepts of medical diagnosis and prognosis. The Hippocratic Oath was written in ancient Greece in the 5th century BCE. And is a direct inspiration for oaths of office that physicians swear upon into profession today. But it's not just doctors, because nurses have an oath, or like RNs have their oath, LPNs have another oath. We all have an oath. Basically, it's the same thing. First, do no harm is in the oath. Okay. In the Middle Ages, surgical practices inherited from ancient masters were improved and then systematized in Rogerius's The Practice of Surgery. Universities began systematic training of physicians around 1220 CE in Italy. Invention of the microscope was a consequence of improved understanding during the Renaissance. Prior to the 19th century, humorism, also known as humoralism, was thought to explain the cause of disease, but it was gradually replaced by the germ theory of disease, leading to effective treatments and even cures for many infectious diseases. Have you guys noticed one trend with a lot of doctors in America? A lot of them come from India.
Yeah.
The thing about their doctors over there, the hospitals are not in great condition. They're not like state-of-the-art like ours. But the Philippines has all the nurses, and India has all the doctors. And then they come here. Sometimes they don't have the greatest bedside manner. I don't know if you guys have noticed that either. They don't. You're lucky if you get a good one. Public health measures were developed, especially in the 19th century, as the rapid growth of cities required systematic sanitary measures. Advanced research centers opened in the early 20th century, often connected with major hospitals. The mid-20th century was characterized by new biological treatments, such as antibiotics. And these advancements, along with developments in chemistry, genetics, radiography, and which led to modern medicine. Medicine was heavily professionalized in the 20th century, and new careers opened to women as nurses from the 1870s, and then as physicians, especially after 1970. Although there is little record to establish when plants were first used for medicinal purposes, which is what we call herbalism, the use of plants as healing agents as well as clays and soils is ancient. Over time, through emulation of the behavior of fauna, a medical knowledge base developed and passed between generations. Even earlier, Neanderthals may have engaged in medical practices. As tribal cultures specialized specific castes, shamans and apothecaries were the healers. The first known dentistry dates to 7,000 BCE. God, I'd hate to have been to the dentist back then. And Baluchistan, where Neolithic dentists used flint-tip drills and bowstrings. Yeah. The first known trepanning operation was carried out in 5,000 BCE in Enshine, France. A possible amputation was carried out in 4,900 BCE in France also. In early civilizations, the ancient Mesopotamians had no distinction between rational science and magic. When a person became ill, doctors would prescribe both magical formulas to be recited as well as medicinal treatments. The earliest medical prescriptions appear in the Sumerian during the third dynasty of Ur. The oldest Babylonian texts on medicine date back to the old Babylonian period between the first half of the second millennium BCE. The most extensive Babylonian medical text, however, is a diagnostic handbook written by the chief scholar. I'm not going to say his name because Esagil Ken Apley of Borsippa during the reign of the Babylonian king. I can't pronounce his name either. I'm sorry. Along with the Egyptians, the Babylonians introduced the practice of diagnosis, prognosis, physical exam, and remedies.
In addition, the diagnostic handbook introduced the methods of therapy and cause. The text contains a list of medical symptoms and often details empirical observations along with logical rules used in combining observed symptoms of the body of a patient, diagnosis, and prognosis. That's why they call it practicing medicine, because it's always changing. And it sounds bad, but that's what you're doing. You're practicing. The diagnostic handbook was based on a logical set of axioms and assumptions, including the modern view that through the examination and inspection of the symptoms of the patient, it is possible to determine the patient's disease, its cause, and future development and chances of the patient's recovery. The symptoms and diseases of a patient were treated through therapeutic means, like bandages, herbs, creams, gels, oils, whatever. In East Semitic cultures, the main medicinal authority was a kind of exorcist healer known as an asipu. The profession was generally passed down from father to son and was held in extremely high regard. Or less frequent recourse was another kind of healer known as an asu, who corresponds more closely to a modern physician and treated physical symptoms using primarily folk remedies composed of various herbs, animal products, and minerals, as well as potions, enemas, ointments, or poultices. These physicians, who could be either male or female, also dressed wounds, set limbs, performed simple surgeries, and the ancient Mesopotamians also practiced prophylaxis and took measures to prevent the spread of disease. Mental illnesses were all well known in ancient Mesopotamia, where diseases and mental disorders were believed to be caused by specific deities. Because hands symbolized control over a person, mental illnesses were known as hands of certain of deities. One psychological illness was known as Kat Ishtar, meaning the hand of Ishtar. Others were known as the hand of Shamash, the hand of the ghost, and the hand of God. Descriptions of these illnesses, however, are so vague that it's usually impossible to determine which illnesses they correspond to in modern terminology. Mesopotamian doctors kept detailed records of their patients' hallucinations and assigned spiritual meanings to them. A patient who hallucinated that he was seeing a dog was predicted to die, whereas if he saw a gazelle, he would recover. The royal family of Elam was notorious for its members frequently suffering from insanity. Erectile dysfunction was recognized as being rooted in psychological problems. Okay, erectile dysfunction kind of is, but not like you're crazy. If you know what I mean. I mean, stress can cause it, and other things can cause it, you know. Stress is a very big problem for everybody. In ancient Egypt developed a large, varied, and fertile medical tradition. Herodotus described the Egyptians as the healthiest of all men, next to the Libyans, because of the dry climate and the notable public health system that they possessed. According to him, the practice of medicine is so specialized among them that each physician is a healer of one disease and no more. Although Egyptian medicine, to be considerable extent, dealt with the supernatural, it eventually developed a practical use in the fields of anatomy, in public health, and clinical diagnostics. Medical information in the Edwin Smith Papyrus may date to a time as early as 3000 BCE. Imhotep in the Third Dynasty is sometimes credited with being the founder of ancient Egyptian medicine and with being the original authority on the Edwin Smith Papyrus, detailing cures, ailments, and anatomical observations. I don't know. Now, every movie you've ever seen about Imhotep, was it, you know, like in The Mummy? He wasn't exactly the nicest person. I wonder if they actually thought about that when they made those movies. You guys still with me, or did you disappear?
What movie?
The Mummy. You know Imhotep? You know the dude who went, you know, the mummy who went to kill everybody?
Oh.
You know what I'm talking about? The one who, they, you know,
yeah,
came back from sucking the life out of. Okay. In that movie, he's not someone who was, who came up with Egyptian medicine at all. That's what I'm wondering, if they even thought about who to make him as, or whatever. See, it's the importance. You got to pay attention to this shit. Yeah. So the Edwin Smith Papyrus is regarded as a copy of several earlier works and was written in 1600 BCE. It's an ancient textbook on surgery, almost completely devoid of magical thinking, and describes in exquisite detail the examination, diagnosis, and treatment, and the prognosis. The Kahun Gynecological Papyrus treats women's complaints, including problems with conception. 34 cases detailing diagnosis, treatment, survive, and some of them fragmentarily. Jesus. Dating to 1800 BCE, it is the oldest surviving medical text of any kind. That's pretty cool. Medical institutions refer to the houses of life are known to have been established in ancient Egypt as early as 2200 BCE. The Ebers Papyrus, written text mentioning enemas. If anybody knows what an enema is, they're not pleasant. So I'm surprised. I did not know they go back that far. Many medications were administered by enemas, and one of the many types of medical specialist was an eri, the shepherd of the anus. Sure. The earliest known physician is also credited to ancient Egypt, Hesra, chief of dentists and physicians. The king Dozier in the 27th century BCE, also the earliest known woman physician. Fichette practiced in ancient Egypt at the time of the Fourth Dynasty. Her title was Lady Overseer of the Lady Physicians. See, you learn something new every day. In India, the Atharvaveda, a sacred text of Hinduism dating from the early Iron Age, is one of the first Indian texts dealing with medicine. The Atharvaveda also contains prescriptions of herbs for various illness. The use of herbs to treat ailments would later form a large part of the, I hate Indian words, Ayurveda, meaning the complete knowledge of long life, is another medical system of India. Its two most famous texts belong to the schools of Chakra and Sushruta. The earliest foundations of Ayurveda were built on a synthesis of traditional herbal practices together with a massive addition of theoretical conceptualizations and new therapies dating from about 600 BCE onward, and coming out of the communities of thinkers, which included the Buddha and others. A lot of our medicine, like I'm saying, is a lot of herbal. You know, all these herbs and plants and things like that. And it wasn't until Big Pharma was created and stepped in and made all these this artificial crap. Well, I say artificial, you know what I mean by, you pop a pill and, you know, and you're good to go. Not everything can be treated with herbal medicine. I mean, it's just, you know, we can't. but it can also keep you from getting to a condition where you wouldn't need medication. Kind of like trying to control blood pressure. There's a lot of foods, a lot of herbs that are diuretics that can help keep, you know, your blood pressure down, and that's the difference. Also, when you lose weight, you have less salt, and you're moving around, and that also helps control blood pressure. So there are some things, like I said, once you get to a certain point, you have no choice but to take medication. The Aruvedic classics mention the 8 branches of medicine: internal medicine, which includes surgery and anatomy, surgery including anatomy, eye, ears, nose, and throat, pediatrics, obstetrics, and gynecology, psychiatrics, toxicology, with treatment of stings and bites, science of rejuvenation, aphrodisiac, and fertility. Apart from learning these, the student was expected to know the 10 arts that were indispensable in the preparation and application of his medicines: distillation, operative skills, cooking, horticulture, metallurgy, sugar manufacture, pharmacy, analysis, and separation of minerals, compounding of minerals, and preparation of alkalis. Good God, our doctors don't even know all of that today. The teaching of various subjects was done during the instruction of relevant clinical subjects. For example, the teaching of anatomy was part of the teaching of surgery. Embryology was part of training in pediatrics and obstetrics. And the knowledge of physiology and pathology was interwoven in the teaching of clinical disciplines. The normal length of the student's training appears to have been about 7 years, but the physician was to continue to learn. As an alternative form of medicine in India, Unani medicine found deep roots in royal patronage during the medieval times. It progressed during the Indian Sultanate and Mughal periods. Unani medicine is very close to Ayurveda. Both are based on the theory of the presence of elements. In Unani, they're considered to be earth, wind, fire, and air. And the human body. According to followers of the Unani medicine, these elements are present in different fluids, and their balance leads to health, and their imbalance leads to illness, which is all of your cardiac enzymes, your blood counts, your white blood count, and all of that. Same thing. They just call it earth, wind, fire, and air. In China has also developed a large body of traditional medicine. Much of the philosophy of traditional Chinese medicine derived from the empirical observations of disease and illnesses by Taoist physicians and reflects the classical Chinese belief that individual human experiences express causative principles effective in the environment at all scales. These causative principles, whether material, essential, or mythical, correlate as the expression of the natural order of the universe. Has anybody been to acupuncture? Have you guys had acupuncture ever?
Yeah, I told you. That's what helps me.
Laura, have you ever had it?
Yeah. No, but I'm thinking about it.
You should. Now, the thing about acupuncture, the Asians, when you go to one, make sure, this is just my personal opinion. The Asian doctors, Chinese, Korean, whoever does it, they will ask you a head-to-toe history of all your medical conditions. The reason being, as I guess, a certain placement on your body as to where they put the needles. Because they don't always do it in the same place. I look like
God,
a freaking pin cushion.
Walking pin cushion.
No, you just lay there. It's about 30. I did it for 30 minutes, and I think that's the longest they really want you to do it. But when I went, I was in London. Go figure, I was in Chinatown. And it was the coolest thing. They say, you're in this little room. It looks like a broom closet. And you got the massage table. And I got a real Swedish massage from head to toe. Yes, they turn you into a pretzel when they do it. And they really do use their elbows, their wrists. You know, I mean, they, you know, pile drive you. And so you're all loosened up. And then after that, I had the acupuncture. And I went through the whole nine yards. Well, the thing is, they play this nice classical music or chime, you know, wind chimes or whatever. And they have lavender incense burning. I fell asleep. They had to go and check on me because I passed out. Honestly, acupuncture does not hurt. I don't know how deep the needles go in. I really don't. But I never felt so good in my entire life than when I got out of there. I mean, I felt like my legs were like noodles, but other than that, I felt better. So
did they tell
I do
you to drink
try.
A ton of water afterwards?
Huh?
Did they tell you to drink a ton of water afterwards?
No.
Yeah, because
no.
When I've done different things like the light treatments and stuff, they always tell me to drink lots of water afterwards.
I've got a bunch of detoxes like yam root, tea. There's like three different teas that I got a detox. And, oh, my God. One of them, oh, crap. You need to add a little bit of sugar because it's bitter as crap. They don't tell you that you can't now, but just enough to take the bitter out. But the yam root, it was really good. And they do work. And it's not something that you do like, I have one today and 2 weeks from now I have another. No, you need to do a proper cleanse. I guess you do one cup a day. And it does. And that's why I'm glad I got those. I'm still waiting on my two herbal antibiotic books because I really want to get off my prescription medications. I hate being on prescriptions. I can't stand it. And I want to be able to do it naturally and just, you know, all the whole homeopathic and my doctor's there just in case. But anyhow, China also, let's see, I'm lost. Hold on. The foundational text of Chinese medicine is the the Yellow Emperor's Inner Canon, because I'm not pronouncing the Chinese word. It was written in 5th century to 3rd century BCE, near the end of the 2nd century during the Han Dynasty. Han Zhengjing wrote a treatise on cold damage, which contains the earliest known reference to the Nijing Xuan, Suwen. The Jin Dynasty practitioner and advocate of acupuncture and moxibustion, whatever that is, Hang Fu Mi, also quotes the Yellow Emperor in his Jai Jing, and I gotta love these Chinese names too. During the Tang Dynasty, the Suwen was expanded and revised and is now the best extant representation of the foundational roots of traditional Chinese medicine. Traditional Chinese medicine that is based on the use of herbal medicine, acupuncture, massage, and other forms of therapy has been practiced in China for thousands of years. And honestly, I think maybe we need to turn to more of that. You know, the acupuncture, the herbal medicine, and things like that. Because, I mean, I get our modern medicine with surgeries and procedures. Yes, you know, there's times you have to have that. But maybe if we get to the beforehand preventative medicine, we wouldn't need all this other crap. But hey, that's just my little 2 cents worth. In the 18th century, during the king, what is Q-I-N-G? How would you pronounce that?
Q-I-N-G?
No, Q-I-N-G.
Queen?
Okay, yeah, dynasty. Yeah, the Q dynasty. There was I apologize profusely when I hack and butcher these names. I do not mean to. I'm just, you know, challenged when it comes to these names. There was a proliferation of popular books as well as more advanced encyclopedias on traditional medicine. Jesuit ministries or missionaries introduced Western science and medicine to the royal court, although the Chinese physicians ignored them. Yeah, CB had problems back then. Finally, the 19th century, Western medicine was introduced at the local level by Christian medical missionaries from the London Missionary Society. The Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church, Benjamin Hobson, set up a highly successful YI clinic in Guangzhou, China. The Hong Kong College of Medicine for Chinese was founded in 1887 by the London Missionary Society, with its first graduate in 1892 being Sun Yat-sen, who later led the Chinese Revolution in 1911. The Hong Kong College of Medicine for Chinese was the forerunner of the School of Medicine of the University of Hong Kong, which started in 1911. Because of the social custom that men and women should not be near one another, wow, that sucked, the women of China were reluctant to be treated by male doctors. The missionaries sent women doctors such as Dr. Mary Hannah Fulton from 1854 to 1927. Supported by the Foreign Missions Board of the Presbyterian Church, she in 1902 found the first medical college for women in China. Oh, come on. That's not a brain fart. Well, crap, I'll think about it later. When reading the Chinese classics, it's important for scholars to examine these works from a Chinese perspective. Historians have noted two key aspects of Chinese medical history: understanding conceptual differences when translating them, and observing the history from the perspective of cosmology rather than biology. In Chinese classic texts, the term, and they have a little symbol there, and I have no idea what it is the closest historical translation to the English word body, because it sometimes refers to the physical human body in terms of being weighed and measured. But the term is to be understood as an ensemble of functions encompassing both human psyche and emotions. This concept of the human body is opposed to the European duality of a separate mind and body. It's critical for scholars to understand the fundamental differences in concepts of the body in order to connect the medical theory of the classics to the human organism. Chinese scholars established a correlation between the cosmos and the human organism. The basic components of cosmology, yin and yang, and the five phase theory were used to explain health, disease, and texts, such as Huang Yi Jin and yin and yang are the changing factors in cosmology, with qi as the vital force or energy of life. The five phase theory of Wu Xing of the Han Dynasty contains the elements wood, fire, earth, metal, and water. By understanding medicine from a cosmology perspective, historians can better understand Chinese medical and social classifications, such as gender, which was defined by a denomination of remission of yang in terms of yin. And I hope you guys caught half of that, because I did not. I just know the yin and yang. The majority of Chinese medical history written after the classic canon comes in the forms of primary source case studies where academic physicians record the illnesses of a particular person and the healing techniques used, as well as their effectiveness. And that's why you have patient charts. When you go to the doctor, you go in, you do a history physical. What did you go to the doctor for? And then they'll do whatever treatment they're going to do, and then whatever medication they give you or whatever. And then it stays in your chart permanently. And that's why you always have to do sign of release so you can get, if you move doctors, so they have your history. Oh, look, this is how many times you've had a sinus infection. This is how many times you've had this and this and this. And they go by how you treat it. So they did all that even back then. Medical case studies existed throughout Chinese history, but individually authored and published cases, case history was a prominent creation of the Ming Dynasty. An example of such cases would be the literati physician of 93 cases published in 1644. The Greek and Roman Empire around 800 BCE, Homer and the Iliad gives descriptions of wound treatment by the two sons of Asclepius, the admiral physician Podalirius and and one acting doctor, Petrosius. Because Machaon is wounded in God. Why? Yeah. I'm sorry. It talks about how all these different doctors, some were injured, and he had to cut the arrow. He got shot with an arrow in his thigh. So cut the arrow from my thigh, wash off the blood with warm water, and spread soothing ointment over the wound. So Asclepius becomes a healing god over time. I am not going to butcher any more names. I can't do it. It just sounds so sorry. Temples were dedicated to the healer god. Asclepia functioned as centers of medical advice, prognosis, and healing. At the shrine, patients would enter a dreamlike induced sleep, not unlike anesthesia, in which they either received guidance from a deity in a dream or were cured by surgery. He provided carefully controlled spaces conducive to healing and fulfilled several of the requirements of institutions created for healing. I guess it'd be kind of like the Native American Indians' use of peyote and some of their trippy medicines they use when you go into a dream sleep and things like that. Three large marble boards dated to 350 BCE preserve the names, case histories, complaints, and cures of about 70 patients who came to the temple with a problem. They shed the problem there. Some of the surgical cures listed, such as the opening of an abdominal abscess or the removal of a traumatic foreign material, like an arrow, are realistic enough to have taken place. But with the patient in a state of ecchymosis, induced with the help of substances as opium. Wrote on medicine between 500 and 450 BCE. He argued that channels linked in the sensory organs to the brain, and it's also possible that he discovered the optic nerves by dissection. I'm sorry if some of this stuff goes over my head too, but this is where medicine came from, apparently. And sometimes I feel lost in the sauce myself when I read this. Hippocrates, a towering figure in the history of medicine, was the physician Hippocrates of Kos. Considered the father of modern medicine, the Hippocratic Corpus is a collection of around 70 early medical works from ancient Greece, strongly associated with Hippocrates and his students. Most famously, the the Hippocratics invented in the Hippocratic Oath for Physicians. Contemporary physicians swear an oath of office, which includes aspects found in the early editions of the Hippocratic Oath. Hippocrates and his followers were first to describe many diseases and medical conditions throughout humorism. As a medical system, predates 5th century Greek medicine. Hippocrates and his students systematized the thinking that illnesses can be explained by an imbalance of blood, phlegm, black bile, and yellow bile. When you go to the bathroom, believe it or not, the color of your poop can tell a doctor a lot about what's going on in your body. Same thing with phlegm when you cough. Is it clear, white, yellow, brown, green? I mean, everything is an indication of what's wrong with you. Hippocrates is given credit for the first description of clubbing of the finger, an important diagnostic and sign of chronic suppurative lung disease, lung cancer, and cyanotic heart disease. For this reason, club fingers are sometimes referred to as Hippocratic fingers. Hippocrates was also the first physician to describe the Hippocratic face in prognosis. Shakespeare famously alludes to the description of the writing of Falstaff's death in Act 2, Scene 3 of Henry V. Hippocrates began to categorize illnesses such as acute, chronic, endemic, epidemic, and used such terms as exacerbation, relapse, resolution, crisis, paroxysm, peak, and convalescence. Another of Hippocrates' major contributions may be found in his descriptions of symptomatology, physical findings, surgical treatment, and prognosis of thoracic empyema, i.e., suppuration of the lining of the chest cavity, that nice pleural cavity. His teachings can remain relevant to present-day students of pulmonary medicine and surgery. Hippocrates was the first documented person to practice cardiothoracic surgery, and his findings are still valid. Well, that's pretty cool. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Some of the techniques and theories developed by Hippocrates are now put into practice in the fields of environmental and integrative medicine. These include recognizing the importance of taking a complete history, which includes environmental exposures as well as foods eaten by the patient. When you go to your doctor, if you're complaining of pain, they're going to ask you, when did it start? What makes it worse? What makes it better? How long does it last? And when did it stop? Same thing if you're sick. What did you eat? When did you eat it? And how long was it after you ate it that you got sick? These are important tools that even nurses, that's why when you go to the doctor, you're going to go to that nurse and you're going to get on that scale, and I just tell them to put fat. But they don't take that answer. And then they do your vital signs, and then they're going to take a brief history of whatever you're there for. They give it to the doctor so the doctor can see, and then they're going to come and ask you the same damn shit all over again. Two great Alexandrians laid the foundations for the scientific study of anatomy and physiology. Herophilus of Chalcedon and Erasure, I don't know how you pronounce his name, Erasurus of Ceos. Other Alexandrian surgeons gave us ligature, homeostasis, lithotomy, hernia operations, ophthalmic surgery, plastic surgery, methods of reduction of dislocations and fractures, tracheotomy, and mandrake as an anesthetic. Ooh, I did not know that. Some of what we know of them comes from Celsus and Galen of Pergamum. Herophilus, the renowned Alexandrian physician, was one of the pioneers of human anatomy. though his knowledge of the anatomical structure of the human body was vast, he specialized in the aspects of neural anatomy. Thus, his experimentation was centered around the anatomical position of the blood vascular system and the pulsations that could be analyzed from the system. Furthermore, the surgical experimentation he administered caused him to become very prominent throughout the field of medicine, as he was one of the first physicians to initiate the exploration and dissection of the human body. And that's the importance of when you're in medical school. I actually did this when I was stationed at Fort Campbell, and all the medics had to do, we all had to do this. We went to the medical school, and we went to where they work with cadavers. Believe it or not, that's how doctors learn, is they work on cadavers. And throughout, from the beginning, from their very first time when they start going in the cadaver lab, they start with, you know, basic stuff. And it goes all the way down, and they work with the same cadaver, I take it, until they get to the bones, ligaments, tendons, and everything. It was pretty cool because that's how I learned all of my medic stuff, was at the cadaver lab. And the most unusual thing, we were there for 8 hours for one day, and they embalm you with formaldehyde, okay? It's funky, the smell, it's really strong at first, and it's also cold in the lab. So after we're there 8 hours, the first thing my sergeant said was, who's hungry? You would think that people would say, oh, I'm not after what, being with bodies. Being around formaldehyde actually makes you hungry. The smell that you've got, it's gotten into your nose, you're actually hungry after being around formaldehyde. I know it's kind of creepy and it's an unusual fact, but it just was. The banned practice of human dissection was lifted during his time when the scholastic, within the scholastic community. This belief, a brief moment in the history of Greek medicine, allowed him to further study the brain, which he believed was the core of the nervous system. He also distinguished between veins and arteries, noting that the latter pulse was the former. Thus, while working at the Medical School of Alexandria, Herophilus placed intelligence in the brain based on his surgical exploration of the body, and he connected the nervous system to motion and sensation. In addition, he and his contemporary Erasistratus, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right, continued to research the role of the veins and nerves. After conducting extensive research, the two Alexandrians mapped out the course of veins and nerves across the human body. He also connected the increased complexity of the surface of the human brain compared to other animals to its superior intelligence. He sometimes employed experiments to further his research. At one time, repeatedly weighing a caged bird and noting its weight loss between feeding times, the physiology, the air enters the body, then drawn by the lungs into the heart, where it's transformed into vital spirit, and then pumped by the arteries throughout the body. Some of his vital spirit reaches the brain, where it's transformed into animal spirit, which is distributed by the nerves. So that's why I think that's why they think of the subconscious mind or the conscious mind. And one thing I thought was kind of funny, a lot of organs of your body you can get a transplant, right? We'll just give you another one. And so I used to think before I went to nursing school, why can't they do a brain transplant? Well, I didn't know at the time that it's connected to your spine. And you cannot do a transplant your spine either, because all the nerves are throughout your body. And that's something that you just can't do. But hey,
so
So I wonder now if them saying that they can't donate blood because of the vaccine, if they can donate organs.
Ooh, that's a good question. You know, I was thinking about that. I was thinking about that. But see, now, if remember we looked on, I forgot what show it was. We looked it up, and it said that, was either the CDC or the FDA or whoever, somebody said that you could donate plasma or whatever. But I wonder if that's just certain places.
I don't know. Because, I don't know, but after watching them videos of the those tubular things in their blood smears and all the blood cells grouping together, I don't know how they could possibly be able to use an organ.
True. And then and the other thing was people that got the vaccine, which is running the risk of blood clots, which is AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson, or was it Pfizer? I don't know which one it was. Now they're saying vaccinated people can't be on a plane, or a lot of airlines don't want vaccinated people on the plane because of the possibility of getting blood clots while they're that high, 30,000 feet up in the air, 16,000 feet or whatever. So, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I wouldn't want them on the plane either. And somebody asked me, I can't remember where I saw it. I don't know if I showed it to you guys or one of you guys shared it, but I thought I saw it. I can't remember where I saw it at. The first vaccine is I don't want to say was created because I don't want to say that because God forbid. They said it was expected to take 15% off your lifespan. The second dose was to take off 35%. Not an additional 35, but from 15 to 35. So 35% in total. And then the booster shot was supposed to take they weren't really positive, but they were pushing 58%. That's their whole thing. And also the sterilization. So, which is why I got in trouble with Fascist Book, because I posted that video from the virologist. And they say, trust the science, but do what?
I said snowflakes.
Oh, well, you know, it is what it is. I mean, hold on. I'm trying to find my dog. Looking outside. Okay. There is a thing behind it, you know, behind the vaccines and all this crap. And in all honesty, I think it's to weed out the weak. Natural selection,
yeah.
You know, and we know to get a vaccine approved, you have to do a controlled group. Somebody's getting the placebo, which is normal saline. You have to have half and half. So you don't know if you're getting the placebo, if you're getting the real thing. Now,
right.
Once the whole trial is over, then it goes completely to a vaccine.
So now here's a twist in the vaccine. Now the appraiser guy was out to my house today, and we got talking about the vaccine, and he's like us. I'm not taking the vaccine. I'm not getting tested. I'm not getting wearing a mask. He's all that. Well, with him having to go out to all these places to get appraisals done, he's been around a lot of people that got vaccinated, and he ended up having nosebleeds for a week from their shedding.
Yeah. But see, this is why you're going to get a lot of people arguing why they say about the shedding and trust the science, trust the science. Yeah, well, you know what? Virologists, world-renowned virologists are telling people not to get the vaccine. In the UK, they stopped giving the vaccine because it's not worth the risk. You go to Veyers, and a nurse read off, and this was at the time when there was only 13,000 deaths, and they're saying that's within a 10% error margin that not all of this, not all of the reactions or deaths or whatever are reported. Okay. So they don't, that, you know what I'm saying? There's a, it's a give and take on either way. But the UK has stopped giving the vaccine because they say it's not, it's the risks don't outweigh the benefits. And they don't.
Exactly.
You know. But I saw a video where this nurse, he was reading off all the whole entire list, and someone asked him if he thought they were safe. He's like, no. But that was his opinion. And in all honesty, if when you've got into the thousands, into tens of thousands of anaphylactic reactions, allergic reactions, now, death, myocarditis, I mean, I'm talking all of the big stuff. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't know. The only time I ever had a reaction to a vaccination was the flu shot. I got a low-grade temp. That was it. That's normal. That's not a reaction. That's normal because your body thinks that it's sick. So your white blood cells will rush to where the vaccine is and attack it and begin to fight it, and it thinks it's sick. That's why you. Some people will get a low-grade temp. The reason why your arm, wherever they give you the shot, hurts is because that's where they gave you the shot. You get a morphine shot in your ass. You get an antibiotic, doxycycline. You can't sit for 2 days, depending on where they put it in your butt, because it hurts. So localized reactions are not allergic reactions. That's normal. Now, when you start, like I did with the hepatitis vaccine, when I was in the military, I had within 30 seconds of me getting it. I'm talking, she stuck me. She turns around to put the needle in the little box. I start projectile vomiting. I couldn't breathe. Okay, and I was breaking out into a cold sweat and broke out into hives. That is an allergic reaction. That's what, and that's part of the reason why my doctor does not want me to have the vaccine. As a matter of fact, she doesn't want me having any more vaccines. She's like, tough shit, you're not getting any more. It's not worth the risk. Because also, I got blood clots from COVID, and she said, getting the vaccine, I could end up with more than just a few than what I had. So she said, it's not worth the risk. So, you know what? If shit goes south, I might just go to my doctor and say, hey, look, I want a medical exemption. You know, it's legit.
Right.
It's not like, it's not, you know, okay, religious reasons, you know what? Religious reasons? No. I don't, in all honesty, for myself, I would not do a religious exemption. That's, you know.
I'm doing it for my reasons.
I get it. I get it for you. I mean, for people who, I mean, but you know, they say 99% of all people who file for religious exemption is just so they don't have to take it. I think that's wrong. I don't think it's quite that high.
Who's eating chips?
I don't think it's huh?
Who's eating chips?
Not me.
That's what it sounds
I'm
like.
I'm drinking Kool-Aid. Yeah. So I'm done arguing with people on the to say, just get the damn vaccine. I said, just keep being a damn sheeple. No. They didn't, you know, when now, don't get me wrong. If this was something like the Spanish flu, the bubonic plague, fuck yes, I'd be getting a vaccine. I'd be wearing a mask. Of course I would. But not something that's got a 0.08% chance of dying from. No. What was the bubonic plague and the Spanish flu? What was the death? The death rate was what, over 50%?
Oh,
on
I
both
don't
of them?
Know.
I know it was high. Ebola's a 30% survival rate on one of the strands of Ebola. 30% chance of surviving. Damn, Skippy, I'd be locking myself in my house if that Ebola strand comes around. But it's in Africa, and chances of it coming here, we had what that scare of Ebola a couple years ago. Only a few handful of people died. So the thing about Ebola is if you treat it, if you have modern – and this is the difference between essential oils, herbal medicine, and modern medicine. Essential oils, it's not going to cure Ebola. Okay? You need modern medicine for things like that. Which is probably the reason why the average lifespan during certain times was 30 years, between 30 and 40, 45 years maybe.
Right.
You know.
All right, who's playing games?
It's not me. It's got to be Bobby. It's not me.
It might be me.
Oh.
Oh.
Who's me?
Phil.
Huh? Oh, Phil.
Oh. Sorry, guys.
I'm just sitting here at my doorway to see if my damn dogs would come back in the house before I can go back to doing what I was doing. Never mind. I swear. Okay. All right, let's go back to okay, the Greek Galen from 129 to 216 CE was one of the greatest physicians of the ancient world, as his theories dominated all medical studies for nearly 1,500 years. His theories in experimentation laid the foundation for modern medicine surrounding the heart and blood. Galen's influence and innovations in medicine can be contributed to the experiments he conducted, which were unlikely any other medical experiments of his time. Galen strongly believed that the medical dissection was one of the essential procedures in truly understanding medicine. He began to dissect different animals that were anatomically similar to humans, which allowed him to learn more about the internal organs and extrapolate the surgical studies to the human body. In addition, he performed many audacious operations, including brain and eye surgeries, that were not tried again for almost two millennia. Through the dissections of surgical procedures, Galen concluded that blood is able to circulate throughout the human body, and the heart is most similar to the human soul. In Ars Medica, the Arts of Medicine, he further explained the mental properties in the terms of specific mixtures of bodily organs. While much of his work surrounded the physical anatomy, he also worked heavily in the humoral physiology. Galen's medical work was regarded as authoritative until well into the Middle Ages. He left a physiological model of the human body that became the mainstay of the medieval physicians' university anatomy curriculum. Although he attempted to extrapolate the animal dissections towards the model of the human body, some of Galen's theories were incorrect. This caused his model to suffer greatly from stasis and intellectual stagnation. Greek and Roman taboos caused dissection of the human body to usually be banned in ancient times, but in the Middle Ages, it changed. In 1523, Galen's On the Natural Faculties was published in London. And in the 1530s, Belgian anatomist and physician Andreas Vesalius launched a project to translate many of Galen's Greek texts into Latin. Vesalius' most famous work, De Humani Corporis Fabrica, was greatly influenced by Galenic writing and form. For the Romans invented numerous surgical instruments, including the first instruments unique to women, as well as the surgical uses of forceps, scalpels, cautery, cross-blade scissors, the surgical needle, the sound and speculus. Romans also performed cataract surgery. The Roman army physician Dioscorides from 40 to 90 CE was a Greek botanist and pharmacologist. He wrote the Encyclopedia De Materia Medica, describing over 600 herbal cures, forming an influential pharmacopoeia, which was used extensively for the following 1,500 years. Early Christians in the Roman Empire incorporated medicine into their theology, ritual practices, and metaphors. Whew. Okay, on to the Middle Ages. From 400 to 1400, the Byzantine and the Sassanid Empire. Byzantine medicine encompasses the common medical practice of the Byzantine Empire from about 400 CE to 1453 CE. Byzantine medicine was notable for building upon the knowledge base developed by its Greco-Roman predecessors and preserving medical practices from antiquity. Byzantine medical influenced Islamic medicine as well as fostering the Western rebirth of medicine during the Renaissance. Byzantine physicians often compiled and standardized medical knowledge into textbooks. Their record tended to include both diagnostic explanations and technical drawings. The medical compendium in seven books was written by the leading physician of Paul of Aegina. Survived as a particularly thorough source of medical knowledge. This compendium, written in the late 7th century, remained in use as standard textbook for the following 800 years. Late antiquity ushered in a revolution in medical science and historical records, often mentioned civilian hospitals, although battlefield medicine and wartime triage was recorded well before Imperial Rome. Constantinople stood out as a center of medicine during the Middle Ages, which was aided by its crossroads location, wealth, and accumulated knowledge. The first ever known example of separating conjoined twins occurred in the Byzantine Empire in the 10th century. The next example of separating conjoined twins will be the first recorded many centuries later in Germany in 1869. The Byzantine Empire's neighbors, the Persian Sassanid Empire, also made their noteworthy contributions, mainly with the establishment of Academy of Gondishapur, which was the most important medical center of the ancient world during the 6th and 7th centuries. In addition, Cyril Elgood, British physician and historian of medicine in Persia, commented, and thanks to medical centers like the Academy of Gondishapur, to a very large extent, the credit for the whole hospital system must be given to Persia. The Islamic civilization rose to primacy in medical science as its physicians contributed significantly to the field of medicine, including anatomy, ophthalmology, pharmacology, pharmacy, and physiology, and surgery. The Arabs were influenced by ancient Indian, Persian, Greek, Roman, and Byzantine medical practices and helped them develop further. Galen and Hippocrates were preeminent authorities. The translation of 129 of Galen's works into Arabic by the Nestorian Christian And I cannot pronounce this guy's name. I'm sorry. Hunayn, H-U-N-A-Y-N. Ishak and his assistant. And in particular, Galen's insistence on a rational, systematic approach to medicine. Set the template for Islamic medicine, which rapidly spread throughout the Arab Empire. And most famous physicians include the Persian polymath Muhammad Zakaria al-Razi and Avicenna, who wrote more than 40 works on health, medicine, and well-being. Taking leads from the Greeks and the Romans, Islamic scholars kept both the art and science of medicine alive and moving forward. Persian polymath Avicenna has also been called the father of medicine. He wrote the Canon of Medicine, which became standard medical text at many medieval European universities, considered one of the most famous books in the history of medicine. The Canon of Medicine presents an overview of the contemporary medical knowledge of the medieval Islamic world, which had been influenced by earlier traditions, including the Greco-Roman medicine, particularly Galen. Persian medicine, Chinese medicine, Indian medicine. Persian medicine was one of the first to question the Greek theory of humorism, which nevertheless remained influential in both medieval Western and medieval Islamic medicine. Some volumes of al-Razi's work, namely on surgery, a general book on therapy, became part of the medical curriculum in European universities. In addition to contributions to mankind's understanding of human anatomy, Islamic scientists and scholars, physicians specifically, played an invaluable role in the development of the modern hospital system, creating the foundations on which more contemporary medical professionals would build models of public health systems in Europe and everywhere else. During the time of the Safavid Empire in Iran, the Mughal Empire in India, Muslim scholars radically transformed the institution of the hospital, creating an environment in which rapidly developing medical knowledge of the time could be passed among students and teachers from a wide range of cultures. There were two main schools of thought with patient care at the time. This included humoral physiology from the Persian practice. After these theories were translated from Sanskrit to Persian and vice versa, hospitals could have a mix of culture and techniques. This allowed for a sense of collaborative medicine. Hospitals became increasingly common during this period as wealthy patrons commonly founded them. Many features that are still in use today, such as emphasis on hygiene, a staff fully dedicated to the care of patients, and separation of individual patients from each other were developed in the Islamic hospitals long before they became practiced in Europe. If you've seen a lot of movies about third world countries and things, it's one big giant ward. There's no dividers. There's no, especially in India, they don't have individual rooms. Now, it may have changed over time, but a lot of hospitals in all these other countries have just one giant room, kind of like a barracks in the military. And it's kind of hard to keep everything clean.
You know where it's
At the time, patient care aspects of hospitals in Europe had not taken effect. European hospitals were places of religion rather than institutes of science, as was the case with much of the scientific work done by Islamic scholars. Many of these novel developments in medical practice were transmitted to European cultures hundreds of years after they had long been utilized throughout the Islamic world. Although Islamic scientists were responsible for discovering much of the knowledge that allows the hospital system to function safely today, European scholars who built on this work still receive a majority of the credit historically. After 400 CE, the study and practice of medicine in the Western Roman Empire went into deep decline. Medical services were provided, especially for the poor. In thousands of monastic hospitals that sprang up across Europe. But the care was rudimentary and mainly palliative. Most of the writings of Galen and Hippocrates were lost to the West, with the summaries and compendia of St. Isidore of Seville being the primary channel for transmitting Greek and medical ideas. Byzantium had and a greater awareness of ancient medicine, but only with the 12th century Renaissance and the new translations coming from Muslim and Jewish sources in Spain, and the 15th century flood of resources after the fall of Constantinople, did the West fully recover its acquaintance with classical antiquity. Greek and Roman taboos had meant that dissection was usually banned in ancient times, but in the Middle Ages, it changed. Medical teachers and students at Bologna, I guess it's Bologna or Bologna, began to open human bodies. And Mondino de Luzzi produced the first known anatomy textbook based on human dissection. Walls identifies a prestige hierarchy with universal educated physicians on top, followed by learned surgeons, craft-trained surgeons, barber surgeons, itinerant specialists such as dentists and occultists, empirics, and midwives. So did you have to read or go through any of the old, like, of the old texts? And stuff where it's everything completely modern, where you don't learn about anything from the past.
Nope. Modern.
Huh?
Modern. Modern.
Oh, just everything modern? I mean, they didn't teach you, like, where everything, how it started?
No, you just learned that. A lot of that you learned it in undergrad studies. Yeah, a lot of that.
Oh, okay. So if you wanted to learn it, you just had to go do it yourself?
Yeah, basically, right? Taking anatomy and physiology, then they would teach you a little bit about the history of anatomy and physiology, like that. But as far as how medicine has progressed, more so they want to teach you now physical medicine. So they take time away from other things.
Because you've got so much to learn.
Right. And when we did cadaver anatomy, we had two cadavers, one female, one female.
Do what?
When we did our cadaver anatomy, we had two cadavers, a male and a female.
Oh, yeah, true. Because of the organs.
But we worked as a group of four. So there was four in the group.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't like your own personal cadaver.
Oh, yeah. How long were you in medical school?
You had to have your bachelor's degree in anything, and then it was 2.5-year master's program.
Okay, and then you go into... Because you know what confuses me, honest to God, is once you get done with medical school, you know, the med student, then you have... was it your residency?
Yeah,
the residency, yeah, fellowship.
Yeah. Residency. Everyone has to do a residency. But when you're a PA, you're actually doing your clinical rotation during that part of, you know, the first year in PA school is all didactic, it's all book knowledge. The second year, you continue the book knowledge, but you start your clinical rotation. And then that last 6 months, that last half a year, is your, what they call your capstone focus. And mine has to be emergency medicine, so I spent that last 6 months in the ER. So I was getting my residency like a doctor does, but during the school time. Doctor, when they graduate from medical school, they get fully licensed as an MD, and then they'll start their residency. And they get paid for it, but it's just not a lot. And I think the residency, if they specialize in like what, neurology or something like that, then they have to go on.
What gets me is your residency, and then is your fellowship. Is that the fellowship is to go into a specialty?
Yeah. Okay. They also call it a residency. A lot of times now doctors are getting PhDs also in addition to their MD degree, because they'll get into a research program. And generally fellowships are with a college or a teaching hospital as part of a college.
Yeah.
So when you're talking fellowships, you know, you think a PhD program where they have to write a thesis and all that stuff. It's more associated with a school. But outside of that, they still consider residencies and what's needed is their residencies and neurology. So they still call them residencies outside of
Oh, okay.
They're different rates too. It just depends. For a neurologist, work under a neurologist for 10 years before you can get their blessing.
Yeah, nursing is like 18 months to however far up you want to. I mean, I think it's awesome. I think it's cool that you could get a PhD in nursing. And so you have a doctorate in nursing. And it's like, you're a doctor. No.
mostly in education.
Now, if someone wanted to get their PhD, would that just be mostly to teach nursing or teach medical school?
Pretty much.
Okay.
For teaching. It's pretty much for teaching and also maybe to get advances as like an administrator or director of nursing somewhere.
Oh, okay. And then you have your chief resident and all that cool stuff. And so after you get your, that's what always confused me, the chief residents and all of that. Because I'm like, okay.
Well, a resident is an employee of the hospital.
Yeah.
And an intern is someone doing their residency, you'd say.
Okay.
Being in charge of all of the people doing the area.
Okay.
He actually puts them with whatever doctor they're going to be, give them their assignment, all of that. So, the chief resident is the most, he's an employee of the hospital. He's a full-fledged doctor. He's usually a senior doctor that's been in the hospital. Chief surgeon, chief president, and you'll have different chiefs at different departments. It's like departments.
Oh, okay. I don't know if all hospitals have these. I've seen a lot of hospitals have hospitalists where they have a 24/7 doctor who's always on duty. Like if your doctor doesn't have privileges, or even if they do, I've been at a hospital where my personal doctor didn't go see me at the hospital. You had a hospitalist.
That's right. And a hospitalist aren't only doctors, but also PAs and practitioners. They can be hospitalists.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Pretty much what the hospitalist does.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Is when a patient comes in after almost 15 hours. Hospitalist I use them at the hospitals where I admit to, and pretty much they'll admit my patient on a weekend or after I get off work in the evening. And then the next morning, they call me up and they give me the skinny on my patient, and I'll decide if I want them to continue monitoring the patient or I'll take control of my patient in the hospital.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, they're very beneficial.
Oh, yeah. Especially when it's after hours and, you know, I was in there when I had my hysterectomy, and the gynecologist, well, she was nowhere to be found, and they had the hospitalist. And they would call him for pain medicine because she gave me Tylenol. And so instead of waiting for your doctor to call you in the middle of the night, that's why I know a lot of hospitals have them.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least I know that's why in Tennessee. You know, it just makes life a lot easier.
Same way in Texas.
Do what?
You know, one of the best paying jobs in the hospital is if a registered nurse, anesthetist, they do the anesthesiology, and they're an RNA, they call them, or a registered nurse anesthetist, and they make $300,000+ a year. So if I was a nurse, I wouldn't go to become a nurse practitioner. I think I would go for the RNA program.
Well, that's what I was thinking about that for the longest time. My God, I wonder how much more school I got to do to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had some pretty awesome nurse anesthetists. I think in all of the surgeries I've ever had, I think I've only had two anesthesiologists. Ever.
Yep. You very rarely see them anymore.
Well, they're there. You meet them, and then you talk to them, and then it's like when I had my kidney stone, I had to have surgery to have it removed and that stent put in. I met the anesthesiologist. I'm like, okay, cool. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, who the hell are you? It's a nurse anesthetist. They should go in together so you at least know. But I'll tell you what. That nurse, holy crap, he did like magnificent. They put me on the table, and he's like, okay. I mean, they've always explained to me, and you know, and when they shut whatever the first thing they give you to, you know, to relax you, I'm like, oh damn, I feel that burned. And then he's like, okay, take a deep breath, and all I remember was maybe 2 minutes. Boom, I was out. Woke up.
Amazing.
And it was like, wow, you're done already? Yeah, 2 hours. And I had no clue. Because normally I wake up in the middle of it, and it's because I warned them, oh, it could take so much to knock me out. Just use a sledgehammer. But it's when they wake you up, when you fight it, I guess is what was told to me, is they don't taper you off. They just, boom, wake you up. And I guess that's the reason why people fight anesthesia. But, you know, it's a blessing when they gradually wake you up.
Well, so a lot of times they'll use conscious sedation where you're actually awake. You just don't remember because you get amnesia. So that's what, you know, a lot of times they'll fight it then, especially, like, for example, you get somebody who is not opioid naive. Maybe they're out there, chronic pain sufferers, and they're taking hydrocodone, or they're taking tramadol, or Tylenol 3 with the codeine. And so they'll come in, and they'll try to give them conscious sedation and, you know, to relax them and then give them some opioids for pain control, and it won't control the pain because they need more. And they're afraid to give you more because of the respiratory depression they could have. So
yeah,
that's when you get guys flopping around on the bed. But if they do like propofol or ketamine, you're actually awake the whole time. You don't even remember it. That's the thing, that amnesia that kicks in. But some people do fight it. And then doctors will recommend whether or not they next time they want to put you under, you know, with the paralytic versus just a bunch of sedation.
Oh, okay.
It happened to me during a colonoscopy.
Yeah, see, that's what happened to me. Yeah, you're partially awake.
Yep, you're partially awake, but at the end of the procedure, you don't remember it. Well, I woke up, and I was feeling pain. I started fighting them. I hit one of the nurses, and the doctor, in his doctor's report, he said, this guy doesn't get conscious sedation anymore.
See, with me, because of the last, and this is the reason why I refused to go to the VA hospital in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. I had an upper and lower GI done. I warned them of my reactions to anesthesia, and I told him, he didn't believe me. I'm like, okay, dude, whatever. I sat straight up during the procedure, and then he proceeded to give me more of, I don't know if it was propofol or whatever he had to give me, but that's when my respirations dropped to like 2 a minute, and then they had to intubate me after I aspirated. And so from that time on, they said, I can no longer have that type of sedation because I have to be intubated for everything. I'm like, gee, thanks.
Yep.
And then one other time when I had to have they had to drain an abscess and a blood clot from a hysterectomy, I was wide awake. I had to talk to the radiologist, the actual doctor who does his procedures. And they're like, no, you can't go to sleep. We have to keep you awake. I had so much medication that they could no longer give me any more. And I had to go through the whole 45-minute procedure in excruciating pain. And there was nothing they could do. Because, like you said, he didn't want me to stop breathing because there was no anesthetist there. So I was in radiology when they did it. But anywho.
Yeah, I've heard stories about them paralyzing people and people can't move, but they're like awake and they don't even know it. They suffered the whole time, but they couldn't move or say a thing about it.
That's scary.
Mm-hmm.
That really is.
It is.
But, Bobby, you still there? Free beer.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, okay.
I'm still here.
Okay. No, I'm just checking. You guys are off quiet. I could finish. There's no way I'm going to finish this up because this goes on and on and on and on and on. So I just figured we'd cover something different. I mean, it's where medicine came from. And it's continued on. And to think like so how they practice medicine back, how they actually learn how the body works and things. And then you have people like Dr. Mengele. Was he really even a real doctor, or was he just a sadist who liked to do experiments on people?
Yeah, there were a lot of those medieval doctors and murderers, and they would do live autopsies on live people. Those neurologists that you were talking about, they would actually mess with people alive. They would mess with their brains and things while they were still alive. So.
Oh, wow.
A lot of the information that they found out was by doing that type of stuff. If you'll look for doctor murderers in history, and you'll see that there was a lot of considered murderers who killed a lot of people just to gain medical knowledge.
Yeah, like Dr. Mengele, Joseph Mengele. I mean, he's the one who experimented. He was in Auschwitz, and he did a lot of the experiments on twins, pregnant women, and things like that. But I was wondering if he was an actual doctor. But they called him the Angel of Death. Oh, he was a doctor.
What?
He really was a doctor.
The Nazis did a lot of experiments on the Jews the same way just recently.
Who?
The Nazi Germany.
They
did a lot
of
medical experiments on the Jews while they were alive. They killed them, trying to
You know, they gain some medical knowledge, physiology of the body, and how much pain a person could tolerate. And, you know, it helped their military efforts, and it helped them with torturing people and that kind of stuff. But so it happens still today. It still happens. You go to southern countries, and they harvest your organs. They'll kidnap you. You go on vacation, they'll kidnap you, and then you'll wake up, and your kidneys are gone, or, you know, you're missing a liver. It takes the liver. You're dead. They can take a kidney, but you can't take them both.
Yeah.
So there's still a lot of medieval medicine going on to this day.
Oh, wow. I didn't know. Yeah, he's quite the quite the horrible doctor. But yeah, he did some. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I didn't realize there were still doctors around today that did awful shit like that. That's why I was wondering, in all honesty, if some people were actually sadists who like the torture. Do what?
That's Kevorkian.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
I mean, I think if I was dying from cancer and there was an operable, I don't know why.
Tomorrow's show, Bobby, just usual whatever's going on.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's tomorrow's show?
Current event.
We do current events. Last week's was an awesome one.
Oh, yeah.
So how about those farmers that have to destroy their crops?
Yes, that's a good that's a good topic, Lorna. That's a very good one. Remind us
Dad
tomorrow
a girl.
Night.
Dad,
hold on.
A girl, I did something.
Hold on. I'm gonna write it down because we'll probably forget.
Yeah.
Okay. Same bat time, same bat channel. it's not just the farmers too. It's also the cattle farmers. They're being forced to euthanize their cows.
Yeah, and they're leaving them no choice too because they're not going to give them. They get federal funding, I guess, or something.
Yeah, they don't. They won't get subsidized. But the thing is,
that's the word.
They will take away their federal subsidy and tax the shit out of their land. See, farmers who do crops to feed the world, you know, the state, everybody, they don't pay taxes on their land. So, That's why they're being threatened. Also, Monsanto with the crops, I guess it's the genetically engineered corn and whatever else that they grow. I'll have to ask Pat about it because he knows all about it. But they have to destroy whatever seed they have left. They can't use it the next year. So Monsanto is making an ass load of money.
Well, not only that, if their whatever blows into the next farmer's field and they find that it's a Monsanto brand, then they're stuck with the Monsanto thing.
Yeah. That, and all this hybrid crap. See, there's something to do with the way they make it, the hybrid, where I don't know. That's why I said I have to ask him about it. What else? Can we, besides the BS, what's going on with?
Hey, I finally came up with an idea, so I just get as that a girl for one thing.
Hey, that's good. And that's all I ask for is ideas. You know, I mean, it's like 5 minutes before the show. What are we gonna do? Let's go and just type it up. And whatever comes up, that's what we're doing the show on.
A clip of a farmer taking out his crops with a lawnmower.
The cherry farmers, the orchards, the cherry orchards, they were forced to dump their whole entire crop of cherries. The dairy farmers have been forced to dump all of their milk. Oh, yeah.
Okay, guys. Well, I'll talk to you guys later. Have a good evening.
You too.
You too. You too.
The truckers are talking about going on strike on the 31st.
Is that here or is that in Australia?
Here, but both. Australia is the one who started it. And, it's because of forcing them to get a COVID vaccine. Okay, here's the thing. A lot of people are pissed off at the truckers for wanting to do this. They're like, oh, you just want to make everyone suffer. No, stupid. You should know how to have enough food in your home, not just day to day. You freaking people get food stamps. You get $2,000 a month in checks. There's no excuse why you have no food in your house. None whatsoever. The only people that should be suffering are the elderly who get what? My mom gets $57 a month in food stamps.
Wow.
And she makes $1,000 a month in SSI.
Hmm.
Sure. If it wasn't for my brother living there, I'd help her out half the time. Yeah, and so it's like, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear why people move. No, there you've got plenty of radio shows, TV shows. I don't care who you are. Always keep at least a 2-week supply of food in your house, at minimum.
I've got plenty of food, so I have my favorite foods, and they seem to go away a lot faster. Then I don't want to cook the other stuff.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway.
Half the time I don't buy anything for snacks. I'm like, shit, I forgot snack food. So what
I don't.
And a lot of time, see, I don't. I try not to get junk food. So what I end up doing is a peanut butter and jelly wrap. It's sweet. There you go. Or I'll eat a bowl of Cheerios or whatever. That's what I try to do. I'm trying to stay away from the cookies and all that crap.
Granola.
Well, that's good, but you can only eat so much granola.
They got all kinds of different flavors now. There's blueberry and there's dark chocolate chunk. There's trail mix kind of stuff. But as long as you pull the raisins out.
Jesus, I hate all those freaking raisins.
I don't like raisins at all.
I like raisin oatmeal, and that's it. Or oatmeal raisin cookies.
Nope.
But then again, I don't eat that many of them. So,
get
a
can of almonds, munch on that. Those are really good for you.
Oh, I know. I used to have peanuts and different nuts, cashews and things like that. And I don't eat. See, my doctor told me don't eat 3 meals a day. She told me to eat like 5 small meals a day because of my stomach problems. And so now my body's used to not being able to eat a whole lot.
It's a good weight loss thing too.
And also,
eaten.
I have a hernia. And I get, it's excruciatingly painful. It's like the gas builds up, and it pushes the hernia up. And, oh, my God, it feels like I'm going to die. And I'll get up in the middle of the night, and I'll just eat something stupid, something small. And it
chocolate
goes away
chip?
Within. No. I used to I'd buy cookies, right? Those little sandwich cookies. I'll eat like two or three of them. Enough to take, you know, or I eat a banana. And
I go through about four bags of chocolate chips every 2 weeks.
Damn.
I know.
What the hell, woman? What are you gonna do when an apocalyptic event happens and you're SOL on chocolate? You better find yourself a cocoa plant.
I know. That's what I'm saying. People will be dying.
Well, the same for me and coffee. I got 20 pounds of coffee put up. I'm like, bitch, I got coffee put away. I'll drink black coffee, even though it's nasty.
I drink coffee, but that's because I quit drinking pop.
Yeah, I don't drink Cokes and Dyke. I don't
I
drink
never
soda
drink,
anymore.
I don't didn't drink coffee until about 5-6 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Bobby, we got, 3 minutes left, 2.5 minutes, whatever.
Yeah.
Free beer and it's still my fish.
It is not. It's Tad's fish.
The hell it is.
It is. He's the one that landed it.
I'm the one who did all the work. I pulled it in. I hooked it.
No. No. Another great show, Miss Kimberly. Thank you so much. Lorna,
and me?
Thank you for being with us. God bless America, our troops, first responders, children, veterans, and God bless the Defender 7. Good night, everybody.
Good night.